You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Front Line.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, May 11th, 2015. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the four-time award-winning The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live, steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal.
And the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Milton Alamadi, he's the publisher of Black Star News, and we're going to be talking about Africa, John Kerry's visit to Somalia, Nigeria in transition after a successful presidential election that saw a former military dictator win an election, plus outbreaks of xenophobic violence in South Africa, and is this connected to the failure of South Africa's second liberation? Plus a whole bunch more in the fun half from me. What else we got, Matt?
We have we'll have a story about what do I got for you guys? Oh yes, this one is great. This is it's literally evil villain like Marvel superhero status. Like we're talking Thanos, we're talking Lex Luthor from Superman. We're talking, you know, the evilest of the evil type stuff from none other than Rick Scott.
Yeah, not really a surprise, but even for him. This story is mind-blowing. It actually is mind-blowing, and we digest this stuff all day.
Also, to fit in with Michael's interview today, we will also have another story from which involves South Africa. And something very interesting that was sort of buried inside a news story about Chicago jails, and it really shouldn't have been buried so far in the story. South Africa is a very interesting look at the jail system in the prison complex in Chicago.
All of that and more. Folks, we're going to take a brief break and be right back with... What's the matter?
Getting your song.
With Milton Alamadi. And we're going to be talking about all the things that we just teased. All right, we'll be right back.
Zombie, 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 not go go unless you tell him to go. Zombie.
Some be not go stop unless you tell them to stop.
Zombie
not go turn unless you tell them to turn.
Zombie
not go think unless you tell them to think.
Zombie.
Tell them to go straight. Ajoro. No break, no jam, no sense. Ajoro. Tell them to go kill. Ajoro. No break, no jam, no sense. Ajoro.
We are back on the Majority Report. My name's Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Milton Alamadi. He is the publisher of Black Star News. Milton, it's great to have you on. How are you today?
Hey, I'm fine. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us, Milton. So there's a lot that I want to get to as we sort of do some limited scanning of the continent of Africa today on today's program. And I want to begin with Secretary of State John Kerry's visit to Somalia, which took place last week. This was a significant visit for a number of historical and security reasons. I want you to outline what that visit is about, the significance of it, and what it reflects about the state of security in Somalia today, and then we'll move from there.
Okay, well, first of all, I think the visit was highly symbolic in the sense that it was good that a U.S. Secretary of State is actually able to now go to Somalia, but we have to remember that his visit was confined to the airport in Mogadishu, which is heavily fortified. And I think the visit was also made for political reasons, to give some assurance not only to the government in Mogadishu that the U.S. supports, but to other members of the international community that are involved in trying to assist that government financially in terms of development and all that. Because it comes following the recent attacks by al-Shabaab, not actually in Somalia, because Mogadishu, while not yet fully secure, is much safer than, let's say, even as recent as 2-3 years ago. But now they're conducting their attacks in neighboring Kenya. They're hitting soft targets, and because Kenya is also involved, because the U.S. actually does not station troops in Somalia, but it sort of has proxy armies, the armies of Uganda, which has a significant, I think it has as many as 10,000 troops, and then followed by Burundi and Kenya. Mm-hmm. So al-Shabaab is now striking inside Kenya, and that was, causing some panic, not only in Kenya, but also raising questions about has al-Shabaab's capabilities really been diminished? So I think the visit by Secretary Kerry was partly to answer that question, that the U.S. is still as committed in supporting the African armies that are in Somalia in terms of going after al-Shabaab.
Okay, so I think that for many people, and another lens that you look at and you cover African affairs through is partially by shedding a light on really how problematic so much of Western and particularly American press coverage is of the continent on many levels. And I think it's very reflected in Somalia. So I think from a broad perspective, people know that, Black Hawk Down, the movie, the horrible incident took place in Somalia. There was a sense, in the early 90s, maybe there was a vague sense that there was a humanitarian catastrophe in that country, competing warlords and factions. Maybe some people have a slightly broader sense of the really problematic role that, Somalia was really kind of ground zero in the most just sort of, ruthless, cynical, opportunistic, and exploitative Cold War politics that both the former Soviet Union and the United States took, full part in and really, aided in harming Somalia in many, many ways. In the current context, we hear a lot about al-Shabaab, and al-Shabaab just sort of floats in the same kind of space that ISIS or Boko Haram or these other kind of horrible terrorist organizations that seem to preach a brand of kind of Salafist fanaticism. But what I would like is a conversation, an explanation of what Al-Shabaab is about in the bigger picture of the recent sort of, you know, the context that, that that they came about in Somalia and neighboring policies and Western policies towards Somalia.
Okay, very good. Well, you touched a little bit about on the background history in terms of during the Cold War, when primarily it was one side playing up Somalia against Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. And Somalia's total descent really started after Siad Barre, who was the dictator for a long time, invaded Ogaden region, which is actually ethnically Somali. But it's part of Ethiopia, and we go back to the whole colonial drawing of all these maps. So Ethiopia at that time was supported by the Soviet Union, and it had a massive army, and it counterattacked and basically destroyed Siad Barre's army, and his government collapsed about a year later. I think it was 91 or 92.
And that was Mosaleem still running Ethiopia at that time?
I'm sorry.
Mosaleem was still running Ethiopia at that time, or
At that time it was Mengistu, right?
Okay.
Mengistu Haile Mariam, right? So after the collapse of Siad Barre, Somali has actually been chaotic since then. So we have for more than 20 years now. We're on 25 years now. Without having to go through the entire 25-year history.
Yeah, of course.
Before what we now see as Al-Shabaab, there was a government of the Islamic courts in Somalia, and it I don't remember whether do you remember at the time when there was a lot of coverage about the laws that were they were invoking banning people from watching films.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the summary justice, including executions, public executions.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Ethiopia was actually encouraged by the U.S. to invade Somalia, to try to, you know, to bring down the Islamic
And is this
government.
Like 2005, 2006? Like it, what time
Correct.
Period?
Okay. Correct.
Okay.
And it was a massive invasion with, right. I think, more than maybe 15,000 Ethiopian troops. But the occupation was very costly. The Ethiopians started losing a lot of soldiers, and eventually they withdrew. And what happened was that the Islamic courts government actually did collapse, and Somalia actually splintered into, it was already chaotic. It became actually much more chaotic after that. And it had basically no government. And that's when, at that time, the U.S. Cobbled together a collection of leadership that was concentrated in Mogadishu, the capital. And the U.S. Got primarily in the beginning Uganda to agree to station 10,000 troops in Mogadishu to support that government. And then in recent years, it got Burundi involved, and most recently, it got Kenya involved. And the U.S. Main concern, the official reason is that a chaotic Somalia would provide the sort of haven where an organization like Al-Qaeda could actually thrive and strike against U.S. interests. Now, I think one of the things that is missing in this whole equation is the fact that there are actually no angels in Somalia. In Afghanistan, the U.S. realized at some point that the government that it supported had to try to find some sort of accommodation, at least try to reach out to the Taliban.
Mm-hmm.
At least it was attempted. And I think the U.S. should have learned the lesson in Iraq when there was a blanket policy, okay, we're not going to have anything to do with anybody who used to be involved with the Ba'athist Party in Iraq. And obviously, later on, it became clear that that approach had been a mistake. I personally think that Somalia does not have a solution that can focus primarily only on the military. At some point, the U.S. will have to encourage the government that it supports in Mogadishu to try to reach out to some elements of the Shabab, because after all, not all of them were in the Shabab until some of them joined in order to oppose a government in Mogadishu that they see as being supported by the outside world and not actually having a widespread support in Somalia itself.
So that
needs to be resolved as well.
Yeah, this is a really important point. I want to actually bring these points together before we move to Nigeria. So it seems like, again, there's a common theme that does cut across a lot of these areas. So we might have a group like the Islamic Courts Union or the Taliban or the Ba'ath Party, for that matter, that certainly by any international standards, regardless of what ideological umbrella they're operating under, are committing atrocities and human rights abuses. And that's, that's a very important issue to focus on, and it's a very valid one. But
absolutely,
what happens is that we then kind of seem to shift from that to, so the Islamic Courts Union, as an example, did not seem to have an interest in expansionist or terrorist activity. It seemed to have an interest in implementing, again, a fanatical and human rights abusing version of Islam in Somalia, which is a humanitarian and potentially a security problem, but it's not a direct terrorism problem yet. Then they go in under Ethiopia. That morphs into al-Shabaab. And now you're saying al-Shabaab has different elements, some of whom, particularly with these horrific things that we see, like in the mall in Kenya and with the college students recently, are obviously terrorist operatives, more in the vein of something like al-Qaeda. But then there's other people that just see this as a continuation of the kind of warlord politics and abuse of Western intervention that has defined Somalia. So they're moving under the al-Shabaab umbrella. And once again, the West is not engaging in a bigger diplomatic or political process. Is that the kind of dynamics
Absolutely.
At play? Okay.
Yes, I think you summarized it perfectly. And to sort of say that, okay, what we're going to try to do is conduct some sort of election in Somalia. I think there's talk of having an election sometime later this year, and that would be a solution when you still have this the division within the country. I think that does not make sense at all. I think what Somalia really needs is a comprehensive, wide dialogue involving many elements, because after all, the players in Somalia are not only the government that's supported in Mogadishu, which, by the way, many of them are very sort of the elite of Somalia, people that are educated outside the country.
Sure.
So you can't just say the solution involves just the government in Mogadishu or some elements of the Shabab. No, there are many other elements in Somalia. There are many important clan leaders who need to be brought into this dialogue. So that first needs to happen before they can even talk about having any meaningful election. Otherwise, the election would just be seen as a fictitious stamp of approval and legitimacy to whatever government that the West really wants to support in the capital.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. And speaking of elections with potential consequences, I mean, Nigeria, who is a incredibly important player, obviously, in Africa and globally in terms of its population, in terms of its integration into the global oil markets, and culturally as well. Nigeria projects a lot. And, and then we have the terrorism and human rights situation with Boko Haram.
Right.
And Nigeria has elected a new president, Muhammadu Buhari, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Right.
He defeated Goodluck Jonathan, which I resent because it's easier for me to pronounce Goodluck Jonathan's name. No, I'm just kidding. But Buhari is a former military dictator in the 1980s in Nigeria. Some people actually might be familiar with not only his sort of numerous human rights abuses at the time. He also went to war against Fela Kuti, who many people know as this sort of, global icon, pop musician, activist, and really music pioneer from Nigeria. Why did the country move back to him? And in the second part, is it possible that he is a somewhat different character than he was in the 1980s? Or do they need the type of thing that they had in the 1980s in Nigeria.
Okay, well, there are many parts.
There's a lot to that. Yes,
it's very telling. It's very telling that they did decide to go back to him. But it was not surprising for many people that have been following Nigeria in recent years. It sort of seemed to be adrift in over the past several months, and Jonathan did not seem capable of rising to the occasion. The Boko Haram, atrocious, but actually, relative to the total size of the country, it was sort of localized to the north eastern region in Nigeria. But yet, Jonathan seemed either unwilling or not capable to handle Boko Haram. And in fact, they, in addition to capturing the 250 so schoolgirls, and that got them global attention, that was a disaster from a PR perspective, because there were many reports in Nigerian newspapers that Jonathan actually went about continuing with his political campaign without realizing that this was a global, at least being seen globally as a number one priority. So he seemed a bit calloused and a bit lost in terms of how to deal with Boko Haram. And then it turns out that the tide started changing when neighboring countries like Chad and Niger became involved. Much smaller countries with smaller armies, but were quite very efficient and effective in starting to push back Boko Haram, released many of not the originally captured girls, but other people that have been kidnapped, and regained some of the territory that had been seized. So people started wondering, you know, with Nigeria, with a big, one of the continent's biggest militaries, was not capable of doing that, and yet these small neighboring countries could do that. I think that sort of sealed Jonathan's fate. Mm. And then there were many stories about the corruption, which Jonathan was also not able to control. There was that story about $20 billion in oil revenue resources just disappearing. So things did not look good for Jonathan. And I think Nigerians, given the choices available, Jonathan and whomever else was running against him, Buhari actually seemed like to be an acceptable candidate. I think that's why he won. And then, of course, perhaps there's the thought that as an as a retired general, the military may actually respond more to his urgings in terms of going after Boko Haram.
Okay, so and he's and also Buhari is Muslim, and Good Luck Jonathan is Christian.
Is.
Did that play a role as well?
Yes, it did. It did play a role, and then to what extent, it's true. People don't seem to really be making that an issue. I've read some accounts that perhaps. His victory was not as clear-cut as it has been reported widely, but that people were nonetheless ready to just have another president in the country.
Okay, so let's move to South Africa, and I think obviously South Africa has plays a very big role in international imagination because of the really unparalleled modern leadership and inspiration of Nelson Mandela. But really also, I would say the African National Congress as a whole actually,
yes,
produced many, that was the sort of interesting quality of it as a movement, is that it was,
yes,
obviously Mandela was singular, but there was Ahmed Kathrada
right,
and Oliver Tambo, a lot of people that if you're kind,
yes,
of interested in stories of liberation or in African politics,
right,
very striking, powerful personalities. It does seem over the past several years and in different ways under the leadership of President Thabo Mbeki, who was also a very interesting and complicated person, and now under the leadership of Jacob Zuma, that there's been some real stalling and some real problems in South Africa. In the course of the spring, there's been this outbreak of xenophobic violence, basically, against,
right,
immigrants from Zimbabwe,
right,
from Uganda, from Burundi.
Right.
I want you to explain the outbreak of that. And then there's this term that some people talk about of the second liberation of South Africa. Are those two things connected, and what is the second liberation?
Okay. Well, it's unfortunate, the attacks and some of the horrific attacks, including killings we've seen globally, because almost all of those countries somehow contributed to the liberation of South Africa in terms of harboring exiles from South Africa, in terms of actually even training the ANC when the ANC was in exile, and in terms of working the mines during apartheid in South Africa. So when we see this this kind of outbreak, it's very disheartening. But when I see this personally, I am also reminded of what Steve Biko said. And Steve Biko, to me, was one of my heroes, and he really spoke truth to power. And if people just go on YouTube and watch some of his old speeches, they'll understand what I meant. Because Steve Biko said, the biggest mistake we would make in South Africa is to merely have a changing of the guard. In other words, the white minority elite that was controlling government and the economy, if what we do in a post-apartheid South Africa, just bring a few, as he said, black faces to take over, and without any significant wealth redistribution, without addressing the issue of the land, without addressing the issue of the economy, then that would be the biggest mistake, and it would be no difference. It would actually be apartheid, with new faces. And that's what he warned against. And that seems to me is what has happened in South Africa. So there are a lot of fundamental issues that need to be addressed in terms of the economy. A very small elite, and now with a black elite also, that have become very wealthy, and they've forgotten a lot of the issues that actually motivated the ANC to fight against apartheid in the first place. So let's look at a person like Cyril Ramaphosa, who is the deputy president of the ANC, and is, I believe, was considered to be a future president in waiting. He is, as of 2012, according to Forbes magazine, he was worth $675 million. Meaning that as of 2015, he could actually be a billionaire by now. And he's not the only of the new black elite that have done very well phenomenally and sort of like forgotten that they need to address many of the issues such as high unemployment, such as poor housing, poor education, and poverty in general, and then lack of wealth. So I think the Africans from other countries are actually being used as scapegoats for not wanting to address these serious issues that they need to deal with.
And is that the second liberation, dealing with housing?
Absolutely. I think that is why a party like Julius Malema's party, even though he's seen by many as a hothead, did relatively well for a party that is running, that ran in elections for the first time. Meaning that obviously there is an opportunity for another party that can address this issue seriously to, in not the very distant future, to challenge the ANC dominance of politics in South Africa.
You know, Milton, as a final question before we jump off, I think that a theme that obviously comes through all of these issues, and particularly talking about the economy in South Africa, but you know, our role in Somalia, U.S. role in Somalia, the elections in Nigeria, are that obviously in each of these situations, there's major problems with corruption and with political elites utilizing state resources. And, you know, it's always worth repeating that these problems show up in different variations, but there's nothing unique about that dynamic in Africa whatsoever.
Right.
That's a universal phenomenon.
Right.
But
yes.
It does seem that the Western push for quote-unquote reform, and it's not to discount that there does need to be reform and corruption busting and all the rest, always seems to have a overlap with basically just programs of austerity and privatization.
Right.
So I guess, I just like your thoughts on that and what, you know, in this obviously very brief time, what does an sort of actual reform package start to look like if it was generated from the bottom up in the continent versus imposed from the top down?
Okay. I've always thought about that. And I think part of the problem is that the elite are largely unaccountable and unrepresentative. So in fact, they really should not be negotiating. They don't have the authority to negotiate with organizations like the World Bank, the IMF, the World Trade Organization, or even major multinational companies that really dominate the economies in many African countries. That is why governance, the issue of governance, is actually very fundamental in African countries. People should have, the people at the grassroots, people should have the right to actually elect the people that rule them. So when you have, dictators who either, stay on for years and years and keep extending their terms, or who come into office by sham elections, and yet they're supported by Western countries just because they fulfill some narrow interest. So let's take a person like the president of Uganda, for example, who's been there for 29 years now and is has very close ties to Washington. He's had very close ties to Washington since Ronald Reagan was president and wants to run again next year. It comes at a tremendous cost to citizens of the countries that they run, and that's often disregarded when the United States supports these different governments that are unrepresentative and unaccountable in African countries. So reform needs to start by people actually having the right to self-determination. In many of these cases, they really don't, because once the leaders come into office, they don't think they need to take into consideration some of the effects of the policies that they adopt on the recommendation of the World Bank or the IMF, because they know there'll be no consequences. They will not be driven out of office anyway. And that, I think, is one of the saddest stories on the African continent today.
Milton Alamadi, I really, really appreciate your time. I just want to note, I'm sure we'll have more conversations in the future, that I found, and if people want to look it up in the midst of all of this fascinating but very depressing news, the movement in Kenya against the value-added tax that the government and international institutions were pushing, which they changed the name of it actually to the maize tax, which means a staple in Kenya. So instead of that sort of policy term value-added tax, it basically was like, look, your maize is going to cost more. That movement was incredibly effective in grassroots. So there are things happening in the continent.
Yes.
And Milton Alamadi, the publisher of Black Star News, thank you so much for joining us on today's Majority Report.
Thank you for having me on your show. Have a nice day.
You too. Be well. All right, folks. I don't know where the boop boop went.
Are you on Skype?
No, I wasn't.
That's only on
Skype. Yeah. I guess we've been doing a lot of Skype calls recently.
Now, this story is the one I was teasing before, and it is truly unbelievable. Now, if I could swivel around in my chair and have my hands, my fingers touch like so, I'm showing the YouTube, my evil, maniacal finger, Mr. Burns
Mr.
style.
Burns. It's a Mr. Burns.
My
yes.
Mr. Burns yeah. hand movement here. And I could also have a large, evil-looking Siamese Persian cat, actually.
Persian cat.
Sitting on my lap, and I would stroke it every now and then. Quite evilly, I might add. I would do so right now. because I would be portraying none other than Skeletor himself, Rick Scott. I mean, I guess Lex Luthor better portrays what you should call Rick Scott now, because he truly is a comic book supervillain right now. If he wasn't already, this has brought him to that point. This is in the Sun-Times. Florida Governor Rick Scott has admitted to lying about why he suddenly supported Obamacare after his mother's death in 2013. The Republican had been a staunch adversary of the health care bill and had vowed not to expand Medicaid, which is a system that helps poor people pay for health care, to nearly 1.2 million Floridians up until his mother passed away. Oh, so I guess, you know, like a lot of Republicans, something has to happen to them first before they show any empathy to those who are experiencing or have already experienced the same thing. We've seen this with Republicans who have now come out for a gay marriage after finding out that, whoa, my son is gay and wants to get married. Guess I got to change my opinion on this. And a slew of other issues. And it seems like this happened to Rick Scott too. Up until recently. Scott pulled a complete 180 and said that he would support Obamacare's Medicaid expansion after his mother died. He said this as long as the federal government was picking up the tab, which it will do in full until 2019. In 2013, Rick Scott said on television that he could not in good conscience prevent Medicare expansion. You know, his mother's death really changed him. He must have really loved his mother. He must have respected that woman, you know, so much that he's willing to change his views, his opinions, his policy, based on something that happened to his mother. However, per the Associated Press, Scott conceded this week, that was the week of May 8th, that this was all a ruse. A ruse. Just like an evil villain would say, it was all a ruse. He now says his support for Medicaid expansion was a calculated move designed to win support from the Obama administration for the state's proposal to hand over control of Medicaid to private insurance companies. At the time, he denied that his support was tied to a deal with the federal government. Scott's involved with a lawsuit against the federal government that seeks to prevent the expansion of Medicaid in Florida as mandated by the Affordable Care Act. And again, he only conceded up to this week that his speech in all the way in 2013 was simply a ploy with a motive. This is a governor of one of our 50 states talking about the health of 1.2 million Floridians whose lives literally hang in the balance. His mother was what he used as his reasoning, his awakening, for changing his opinion to deny those 1.2 million people of that basic right of healthcare so they can live and survive. And he comes out now and says it was all a ruse.
It was a ruse.
You fools! You thought I actually loved my mother? The joke's on you!
Mommy dearest, just so you know, I'm going to be using your death to deceive the federal government about giving poor people healthcare. It's a fabulous ruse.
Just amazing, really.
I could give a handout to my buddies in the private insurance industry, which I already have a criminal background in.
And by the way, this is the week of Mother's Day. What a perfect time to come out and admit it's all a ruse. That's how much I love you, Mummy.
Oh, my God. No, he was under criminal suspicion. He was never convicted of anything, if I recall, but he was actually under suspicion of, like, massive Medicare fraud. And was in part of legal depositions. And
And then, you know, I mean, that level of overt sociopathy, it's, I mean, and of course, over 1 million people, because this guy is mind-blowingly sociopathic.
Talk about a guy with issues. Yeah. My God. I mean, that's how the origin stories of supervillains usually begin. I mean, really?
Well, how did it begin for Rick Scott? Do you have the story?
I mean, it's got to begin with his mother somewhere, I assume.
Was it like, Ricky, you didn't make the football team again. You'll never amount to anything.
I'll show you, mother.
I'll show you, mother, and I'll show all the poor people that I see.
Wait, I mean, he's literally the guy from Psycho. I could totally picture this guy pretending his mother's still living up in the attic, and it's really him dressing up as her.
Whoa.
Unbelievable.
Governor Bates. Governor Norman.
Governor Norman Bates, yes.
Governor Norm. All right. All right, everybody. We are going to be obviously taking your calls at 646-257-3920.
That's 646-257-3920. Just helping you out a little bit there.
And the IMs are open. Just helping you out a little bit.
That's how we roll here on the majority.
I was helping the audience out. You helped me. I helped the audience.
Yeah.
What else is going on, dude, before we go to this
Not
fun
much.
Half?
How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. I had a...
happy Mother's Day. Belated
Mother's Day. Yes, happy belated Mother's Day to all the great moms in the Majority Report audience. Did you call your mom in time? I'm sure you did.
No, I wished her a happy Mother's Day.
Of course. I was on Arise yesterday on the TV channel. It was funny. Everybody in the green room was just sitting on the phone calling their moms. It was hilarious. It would have been a great little YouTube video. And then this woman who was there does this amazing work on childhood mortality rates. And she was saying to me, you should get your mom a card from our organization and like a little donation will go to the group. And I looked at her and I said, yeah, I mean, it sounds great, but my mom doesn't support public health. And I just stared at her. And everybody else in the green room started laughing, but she was like the last person to get it because I held a steady. And then I was able to build. I was like, my mom would say, well, I gave birth successfully to you. What does that issue have to do with me? I'm your mother. And she was just like, oh. Anyways, it was very funny. I enjoyed myself.
That is very funny.
All right, everybody. Become a member of the Majority Report today. You know how you can do that by going to majorityreport.fm/become a member. Less than a cup of coffee a day. You make this show possible. Literally, it's a very unique and very awesome thing. It allows conversations like the one we just had to happen, conversations like all of the great conversations we have happen. It allows us to have unflinching positions and different opinions. The three of us disagree sometimes. And you disagree with us, and we read your IMs, and we take your calls, and it's great. And you know that conversation, even in the new media space, is pretty unique, very exceptional. So support the show today. Go to iTunes, subscribe, write us a review. We want a new review every day. That would be awesome. We really enjoy it, and we'll keep curating, checking the reviews out. Share the show with your friends. Subscribe to us on YouTube.com/Sam Cedar. That's our YouTube channel. Everything's cut up and presented there. Follow us on Twitter. Like us on Facebook. Follow Matt on Twitter, at Matt Binder. He's a Twitter wizard. You will never regret following Matt on Twitter. Follow me on Twitter. I'm very good at Twitter. I wouldn't say I'm a Twitter wizard. @_MichaelBrooks. Follow Sam Cedar on Twitter, @SamCedar. Terrible on Twitter, but he's the star. So you got to follow him anyways.
He does have more followers than, but it was actually not that far ahead of me, so...
They're both very far ahead of me, so help me feel better about myself. Follow me on Twitter.
I would actually really be sincere here. Yeah. If there's one person to follow on Twitter, if you want to be nice,
A little condescending there.
I'll be nice.
My ratios are damn good, thank
Michael
you.
Michael does have nice ratio for follow and following ratios. But yeah. Follow Michael. Help the guy out. He deserves more followers than he has.
And I really – I joined Twitter so late. That's why I have the underscore thing. And I didn't really start properly tweeting until like last year basically.
So you gotta learn from Carly Fiorina's mistakes, Michael.
I'm learning.
I'll get to that in the better half too.
Perfect. I love it. All right, everybody. Phone calls will be on in a minute. IMs are ready to go. We will see you in the fun half.